Okay. Take 27. We are very excited. This week, we have a friend of the pod with us, back with us again. The Sophie Jordan is with us, everyone. Sophie, we love you.
I'm back.
Welcome, welcome.
So happy to be here again.
So we were talking, this is your second visit to the podcast. Is that true?
I feel like that's
I think
wrong,
it feels like you've been with us more. Certainly Jen has talked about you a whole lot.
Fine, be that way. I'm not even sad. You know what? There is like no more apologizing at all in this world for the things that bring you joy.
Nope.
Like that's how I feel.
I mean, I'm never going to complain. Sophie Jordan brings me joy in her face and in her books. So aww, we can talk about her anytime. But we're actually, Jen and I have been talking a lot about how we've now sort of cultivated, we've curated a very, you know, interesting list of people who we really, really love, who we like to have on multiple times. And I'm really very surprised that you are only a two timer. It feels like you should have been here more than that. But now you're in a race because Jen and I are like trying to figure out, like, it should be Saturday Night Live does this whole thing where there's like a five timers club and a 10 timers club and a 15 timers club. And like, you know, everybody's like Steve Martin and whoever else are in a battle for like who has Alec Baldwin, like, you know, so what we want to do is like we have an idea for the five timers gift, but like, if you come multiple times, you get a present eventually.
It's going to be amazing. Right now, Adriana and Kate are like neck and neck.
I need to catch up. This is number two. I want a Fated Mates Lifetime Achievement Award. That's my goal. Goals.
Sure. Sure. I think it could be maybe like a pink ladies jacket.
Oh, that's right? A dream. I would love that. Pink ladies. It just looks so soft and, you know, I'm already imagining how it's going to, I will wear it to bed.
I feel like the real winning thing though would be like, you get to, we all go somewhere together and it's safe to do that. And we sit around and we read books.
Fated Mates, like multi-timer retreat.
Yeah, there you go.
We all just get together, read books, and talk shit. That's what we do.
We just read and talk and eat and drink. That would be a fantasy when all this is over. Yes.
This award is the biggest farce I ever saw.
What about the Emmys?
I stand corrected.
That would be pretty great. I'm for it. You guys, I just want to go to a restaurant. That's all. Like, I feel like that would be such a joy.
I'm not sure if this happens to everyone else, but every morning I wake up and I think like, okay, what's my day going to be like? Like it still hasn't really kicked in, right? And then I find myself doing things like yesterday I washed windows.
Oh my God.
We cleaned yesterday.
I haven't gotten that desperate.
It was quite a thing. And I was just like, what am I doing? And I thought, well, it's novel.
When was the last time I've done this?
It feels like I cleaned toilets yesterday. Like, when's the last time I voluntarily did that? I mean, not that my toilets are gross, but usually, you know, whatever. I can coax someone else to do it for me. But
but it breaks up the day. I know a lot of people like to be homebodies and I like my house fine, but my God, I want to go to my coffee shop more than I want anything in the whole world.
Yeah, this is definitely a test to my introvert spirit because even introvert me is like, wait a minute, this is getting a little much.
I know. And our children are just here all the time. I feel like I've said this on other podcasts, but like my kid is still here all the time.
Everybody needs a break from everybody.
Maybe. Well, I'll tell you the mistake I made, which is I needed like supplies for my cats. And so Kelly told me about Chewy.com where she was like, and basically she was like, they deliver cat litter. And I was like, sold. And so I was like, well, I'll order like cat food and that you can put it on like auto buy. So here's the thing. I like ordered the dry cat food my one cat eats. And I was like, oh, I'll just get like a little bit of a bigger bag. And I was pretty sure that I bought like a 16-pound bag of cat food, which is huge. I guess I buy 4-pound bags of cat food normally. And this thing came, and my husband was like, what the fuck did you do? And I was like, apparently, weights and measurements mean nothing to me. That's, and so I actually think, like, there's no way that my cats can even eat it before it goes stale. And so I might try and see if I can donate it somewhere this week. Like, I just fucked it up entirely and ordered the wrong thing. Like, what? 16 pounds of cat food is a lot, by the way, everybody. It's huge.
Share the wealth. I think my funniest tweet, like, and I won't get the wording right, was just someone, oh, sorry, there goes my dog.
Yeah, see, the dog's like, I'll eat the cat food. I volunteer. I know.
The dog's like, don't share that. Put it in my mouth.
The dog's also like, you haven't said welcome to Faded Mates yet. That's what else the
dog said. God. Oh. Welcome, everybody, to Faded Mates.
Blame it on the quarantine brain.
It's true. We're all just doing our best. So, wait, who's banging around?
That is my son walking up the stairs. Go away. I love you. Goodbye. Go do your thing. Go.
Thank God you weren't talking about anything untoward.
I know.
I think.
Wait, did you send the kids on a walk, Sophie? Because last time, you want to tell our listeners about the last time you were here?
That's true. So the last time.
She's listening. She's going to whisper.
I am. So the first time I did my Faded Mates, only my teen daughter was in the house. But after the call ended, she asked me, Mom, were y'all talking about the plugs? Plug it in, baby.
And you were like, yep. Well, we were, because you came on for The Master. And I mean, if you're going to come on for a show, for a book.
That's going to come up. For
yeah.
Sure.
I mean, shout out to our Chastity Belt search people who find us pretty regularly. That is my favorite thing about the Faded Mates website is you can look at, like, as with all websites, you can look at the search terms that drive people to the website. And Chastity Belt porn is a thing that drives people to Faded Mates because of The Master. And so, you know, welcome, everyone. We hope you're still with us.
Whatever brings them. Welcome.
Sophie has returned for you.
Yes. Yeah, so this time my 12-year-old's in the house.
Oh, boy. Well,
not just my 17-year-old.
All right. Well, but we're not going to be talking about butt plugs today. I mean, I don't think.
I don't think it's going to come up. There might be. We're here for new things.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Sophie will just whisper. And it'll be
like, you'll just whisper, butt plugs.
Full ASMR for this. And then we'll come back to it. Okay. But we are here. So it's basically a freewheeling episode. We kind of said, you know, because we love you. And you have a new book out. Which is very exciting for Jen and me. And Jen and I we've read this. I mean, I read it ages and ages ago and told and basically lorded it over Jen for a while.
Real mad. I was like, wait, what? It's not okay for you to do. Ma'am, how dare you?
Because it's so, so hot. It's so hot. And I want to tell everybody. So Sophie and I are very good friends, as you all know. Anybody who's a longtime listener knows this. And so often we know about each other's books, you know, years in advance. Like we know what I know what book she's working on 3 books from now. This book, which is an aphrodisiac book, we plotted together in Kiowa Island, South Carolina. I mean, years ago, I remember being on a walk.
I mean, all I had was the fact that I wanted to write aphrodisiac. There was no story to go with it. I had to write an aphrodisiac book because it's a thing I love.
About, I don't know, 8 or 9 months ago, Sophie called me and said, I'm concerned that the book is too hot. And I was like,
true story, true.
And I was like, well, I mean, I understand that, but you should send that right to me. And I will let you know.
Immediately, I will let you know.
And here's the thing. It is the right hot, the right amount of hot. And Jen has now read it and she can speak to it too.
I loved it. Well, I think, one of the reasons we're also here today, because I want to hear Sophie talk about, like, this book is we've had a couple people of our long-term listeners be like, you're throwing around this take the finger phrase just all the time, but like, what does it really mean? And it's actually, we've sort of stolen it. I have sort of horned in on this. This is something the two of you, I think, sort of came up with. And we talked about it on a podcast like forever ago. But really, one of the other reasons that we wanted you on to talk about your book and this is like, you know, what does it mean to like come up with a premise and like sort of follow through, even though you know that it could be potentially
problematic? Yeah.
Like risky. Problematic or risky or a little scary or people won't like it or you know, the potential for it being judged more or whatever it is, right?
Well, you know, it's on the Simone scale, right?
Yes. And so this seemed like a really good opportunity to like sort of return to like sort of taking the finger as an idea and what how that plays out for authors and for readers. But also like then this is a book that sounds like rang that bell for you as an author, right? Where you're like, can I do this thing that I want to do?
So we, I just also want to say, one of the longtime listeners who encouraged us to revisit the definition of take the finger is Eric, who was like, I have literally listened to this podcast more than anybody in the whole world, including you two idiots. He was like, and I do not understand what this means. So
he still needs clarification.
Okay. Well, because we only did it the one time. And then we've just used the phrase all the time. Like I used it, Sophie, I used it when we talked about Lorraine Heath's Waking Up with the Duke and how she just like, she takes the finger in that book. Like it's a cheating book. It's like, it's all about, you know, it, like the whole premise of the book is this, you know, the heroine's husband is dying, is like cannot have a child. And for the hero and heroine to be together, he has to die and they have to cheat on him.
Right.
So I,
which is a lot of it checks a lot of no boxes.
Checks a lot of boxes. Yeah. So, but the only way for that book to work is for somebody to really lean into it. Like you have to, she takes the finger, right? So why don't you start by explaining to everybody how we came to this? Because we also, I think, need to clarify that this is in no way an insult to the original author.
Oh, yeah, no. Oh,
in fact, no. It's like pure love for her. So,
I want you to define it. And then I want to talk a little bit more about what I like, how it comes across. Like what I think is risky about it, too, is that like the reader, like your relationship with the reader. Right.
Sophie and I spend a lot of time emailing each other about bananas books, like books that like we think really operate on this kind of wild, on the wild scheme. And we're really interested in books that do that, just like Jen is. But before we had a podcast, Jen and I, Sophie and I would just text about these wild books. Like she was my podcast. And
so, yeah. And I mean, that's how Bananas books came up between us. Bananas. Yeah.
Those of you who have been at events with Sophie and I know that we often do a panel called Bananas Books, where we just talk about these like wild books from the past that we love a whole lot. And so we're always really full of joy when we find a new author who really is kind of operating on all cylinders, firing on all cylinders for this particular, in this particular way. So people like Cressley, right? Who just kind of balls to the wall, right? You know, these wild premises like Mr. Vivisection becomes a hero because of course he does, right? So a while back, several years ago, Sophie and I read Annika Martin's Dark Mafia. It's Dark Mafia Prince, right? That's the first book?
Right.
Okay.
I think so, yeah.
The Dark Mafia Prince series, which is about three brothers who, you know, are orphaned when their father, who's in the mob, who's a Russian mobster, is killed by another Russian mobster who he thought was his friend. And that sort of the killer Russian mobster then became like king Russian mobster, and he had a daughter, and the brothers came back for vengeance, and like vengeance stories are absolutely my jam. And so Sophie and I read these books, and we read them in like a minute and a half. Like, we could not.
I did the same thing, not with you, but I had the same experience.
Bonkers. And so it's like the two, there's like the oldest, who's like the hero of the first book, the middle, who's absolutely insane, like a madman, and, you know, makes real bad choices. And then the third brother, who's literally feral, like raised in the wilderness by animals, right? So, I mean, it's crazy. And so, so Sophie and I started texting back and forth, and there's a scene in the first book where the second, where the middle brother, who is like, really just crackers, has like threatens to cut off the finger of the heroine
of book one,
of book one. And the hero's locked in the trunk of a car, and the guy, this, the brother who will ultimately be the hero of book two, you sort of know it's all teed up, right? He's like, somebody go to Staples and get me a paper cutter. And he sits down with her and he's like, here, you're going to want to drink a lot of vodka because this is going to hurt. And then he like puts her finger in the paper cutter, and lo and behold, the hero like breaks out of the trunk and like comes and saves her. And it's all great. And Sophie and I spent like more time than we really should have talking about the fact that like what we really wanted was for like this second hero to just take the fucking finger. Right. We wanted her finger to get cut off.
I mean, my adrenaline was so high in that moment.
Totally.
And it's
right.
So awful that as a reader, you're like, yeah, and take and the finger.
The worst part about this, as I mean, worst slash best, is that as a reader, you know this is the next hero. Like, you know it. And you're like, right. I don't care. Let him paper cut her to death. Right? And so here's my official apology to Annika, because I feel this is Annika Martin's books. You guys, we love these books. These are great. Really, this
Definitely.
Is a really fun books, quarantine read. And I just fear sometimes that Annika thinks that when we say take the finger, we are somehow saying that Annika didn't do it and it wasn't good. I think what we're actually saying is like, no, Annika set it up so that we were so invested in this second hero, even if he was a total sociopath. Right? Which is what he was.
Yes.
And so Annika, we love you. I know you came to me on Twitter and you said, no, Sarah, he should not have taken the finger. and I just want you to know, like, we think you're great. And, you know, everyone out there, like, we think Annika's great. And we still think that he totally could have paper cutted that finger and you could have made it work. Because you're very talented. But the point is that now it's kind of taken on a life of its own.
Well, and I want to say, like, the more we use this phrase on the podcast, I think it certainly has that element of, you know, like, of leaning into whatever premise it is that you have decided to put on the page. And that doesn't necessarily mean it has to be completely bananas with, you know, paper cutters involved, but that we're encouraging authors to like write fearlessly. So this is really about authors. It's not really about readers, but my sense is, as the reader of the three of us, I mean, you're all both readers too, but you know, pure reader, is that one of the impediments like is it's genre fiction, right? Like, and genre fiction comes with a certain set of promises. And in romance, we know about the HEA, but I think we also, there's a lot of other things that like we've unpacked a lot. And then there's a lot of landmines, things that are just really hard to like make happen in a book. And so when we see, and so sometimes it's like, if you're going to approach the landmine, you know, you have to be willing to like sort of set it off maybe if that, and I think there's a lot of ways in which this plays out at what I think of as being like the corners of romance, right? Like pushing out against the boundaries of whatever it is that we think reader expectations are, because that's the people that would frown upon you taking the finger, right? So there's some sort of interaction between those two that also, I think, kind of probably plays into that, like, internal voice being like, can I really do this thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think Sophie and I have spent a lot of time, you know, we have this ongoing thing between us where, you know, if one of us has an idea and we think to ourselves, like, I don't know if I can pull that off, you know, which often is, it's one of two things. It's either like, I personally don't know that I'm a good enough writer to pull it off is always part of that. But then there's the second sort of voice that what I sort of think of as like the Twitter voice, right? Where it's if I write it, how much hate is it going to get, right? And I think, and often Sophie and I have this moment where we're like, I don't think I can pull this off, right? And be able to really do it right. And we're always saying to each other, like, well, then that's why you have to write this one, right? Like you constantly be pushing yourself toward Mr. Vivisection, right? Like that's the goal.
Right. If you feel like you're doing something risky, you're probably on the right track. But it's just it is a internal
struggle. But it's risky.
I didn't know when I wrote Duke Buys a Ride, I felt like just the title alone, it made me uncomfortable. And sometimes I think when you're writing in this space of taking the finger, you're feeling uncomfortable. You're feeling a little uncomfortable.
That's the only way that you can do it right, though.
Right. Exactly. What I'm feeling, those nerves are translating, you know, that anxiety. I'm feeling anxiety writing it. Then I know my reader is going to feel the same anxiety in the best way, right? The anxiety, the fear for your characters.
Right. And also, though, but as a writer, when you're feeling that anxiety, it means you're being more careful. Like you're thinking about. And one of the things and I talk about all the time on this podcast is like, in order for you to fully understand these tropes that edge into the taboo, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have to be able to understand why they are taboo and why they really, like, fundamentally, when you strip them down, why they work or don't, right?
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think that's exactly right. And so maybe this would be a great time to have Sophie talk about the Virgin and the Rogue, because I feel like there's a lot of, like, control rods that you put into this book to keep it from, like, running away. Like, right? Like, sort of getting out of control.
Well, the aphrodisiac trope, it was so funny because I posted something about this not long ago. And I'm like, does it qualify as a trope when it's really not done that often? And someone was like, absolutely, I love that trope. And I'm like, okay, because there's only a handful of aphrodisiac books I can think of from old school to now. You know, I think of the original, I think of Johanna Lindsay's Secret Fire, and I read that book so many times. And of course, in true old school Johanna Lindsay, it's problematic in a lot of ways, but wonderful at the same time. So I just, for years I'd had it, just like Sarah had mentioned, like I had it in my head. I didn't know anything about the story or the plot line except that I wanted to write an aphrodisiac book. And I think part of when you're talking about control rods is I think that the thought of someone drugging someone else, that just is, it makes people extreme. Right. It's illegal for a reason. It's like, you know, a girl today getting roofied in a bar. That's horrible. That's horrific. So I think the important thing is for the fantasy to be a positive fantasy is that, you know, the hero or the heroine whoever's, you know, dosing the other person with aphrodisiac, it doesn't come from them. It's an accident almost. Somebody else has done it to them, you know?
Right.
I think that for me was part of the control. And in The Virgin of the Rogue, my heroine gets dosed by her sister who thinks she's giving her a tonic for PMS cramps. I mean, and I think that added a little levity too, you know, and realism. Because, I mean, surely.
Why else would she be mixing up tonics? Right, exactly.
But what's so amazing about it is the way that you tackle, and I don't want to ruin it for readers, but there is, as you pointed out, there's a consent issue here, right? Like, if she's under the influence of an aphrodisiac, how could consent sort of exist? Right. And you do it so masterfully. And I mean, Jen, finally, when Jen read it, I was like, you have to tell me when you get to the end of that scene.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's such a delight. It's such a delight, and it's such a thoughtful way of tackling it. I had to think and also about that. Super hot, super hot.
Right. Did I want consummation to happen while they were under the influence of an aphrodisiac? How far did I want it to go while under the influence? I mean, in the original Secret Fire by Johanna Lindsay, consummation happens under the influence of the aphrodisiac, and it happens many times because she cannot be satisfied. I mean, they have round one, and she's still in torment and in agony. And the servant tells the hero, oh, well, sometimes we have to bring in forces to help women when they're under this aphrodisiac. Like, it's, you know, I've seen women take horses. No kidding. I've never forgotten that line. And the hero is like, I can see the hero in my mind, like, kind of raising his fist in the air. By God, she will require no horses.
See the look on my face right now. Well, you know, I think part of this too, I think what's really hard is, you know, we've talked about Robin Lovett's Planet of Desire series, yes, where and I think that there's a way in which setting it down in historical or setting it down in a paranormal or sci-fi kind of world, right? Like, I mean, it's really interesting. The one in a contemporary, I think it's really hard. And the one where I've recently read, like, sort of a delightful, really kind of amazing aphrodisiac plot. And it doesn't really play out this way at all, like in the same way as in Tasha Harrison has a book called A Taste of Her Own Medicine, and her grandmother. And it's really cool, actually, is like essentially like a medicine woman. And I forget like the actual term, and her Sonia's our heroine, and she's just been recently divorced. She's 40. And her grandmother is kind of like, I'm going to give you this like come to me potion. And she's like, no, you can't do that. But I think the thing about that book is there's so many ways in which it sort of leans in to. And I mean, we're talking about like premise here, but I think the other thing that's really hard to do, and I know this is going to sound bonkers, but I think it's really hard to create emotionally vulnerable heroines, because I think we're really invested in seeing heroines as being strong. And in this book, Sonia, the hero, is 30. So this is, you know, she's 10 years older than him, and they're out at a bar, and he like basically tells her how beautiful she is, and she starts crying. And I was like, holy shit, like, to allow this woman to be really vulnerable, to like have gone through a terrible divorce and have a man like compliment her and have her really like be so emotionally overwhelmed by it felt risky to me. Right. Because yeah. You're mm-hmm. really showing a heroine as being like truly emotionally vulnerable, when I think I often come into the romance space wanting women to be strong. And I think it, like, there's a book that it's a different kind of taking the finger than, like, you know, obviously, but
yeah,
I think a lot about how much I value those moments where we see people really truly being vulnerable and feeling like she flees, essentially, like she's just like, oh my God, right. I'm so horrified, I'm out of here. And I have never felt so like truly like, wow, that's a risk, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's the difference between, I mean, it's authenticity and fantasy are often, they have to exist simultaneously in romance novels. And in the best ones, they do, but they are both incredibly difficult to nail.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And I bet there are people, I was just saying, I think it's hard when you feel that, like, it's back to discomfort. And in this case, it's me as a reader. I'm like, oh my God, like right? It's hard to see our characters that we love and want to fall in love with as they fall in love feeling like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, there's a reason, you know, I don't write, even in historicals, too many virgins necessarily anymore, just because I've written that book a lot. I'm an older woman now, and I have been writing for a long time. So I don't necessarily, the virgin heroine isn't my go-to anymore. But for this book, it was the only way, because of that thing you're talking about. I couldn't very well title the book "The Mouse and the Rogue," but that's what it is. I mean, the woman who's going to take the aphrodisiac and totally come out of her shell and really kind of have growth throughout the whole book, become a new person because she's been awakened, has to be a woman that's not already there, you know, that already isn't, you know, out and necessarily secure and confident. So that's why I had to go with a virgin.
Yeah, and in the reverse, right? Mm-hmm. The aphrodisiac also shows the hero a part of himself that he did not think existed, right? Like, the fact that in the moment he's like, oh, shit, like, I can't just, like, I can't just take her because that would be wrong.
He has, so suddenly he has the restraint he doesn't usually have.
Right. And he's not a scoundrel. Like, suddenly he's like, who am I if I am not a scoundrel?
Right. I thought I was a scoundrel, right? I was the rogue. Mm-hmm. And yet here I am doing the right thing. Something's not right here.
And I mean, I love that. I mean, that's reformed. Yeah, I do too. Reformed rake is, you know, it's a trope for a reason. And it's delicious.
But I think that's the thing about, like, taking the finger, right? Like, the aphrodisiac or the paper cutter or the whatever. Like, all of it's just about who these characters are at, like, a moment of crisis. Yeah. And I think for me right now, as we're all facing, like, really something unprecedented and, like, sort of, like, really facing, like, kind of who we are and what we're made of and what our families are made of, I think, like, there's a reason why books with, like, big high stakes like this appeal to me so much right now, because I need to know that I can get through it, right? And so books where people face their greatest fears or face, like, these challenges are important to me.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I'm seeing so many people going back to the classics, the, like, old school classics right now, and rereading. And I mean, obviously, I'm always interested when people decide that they're going to reread, like, the old books. But for me, the last couple of weeks have really been about the books that have given me the most joy have been the books that are kind of wild. Like, we reread Nobody's Baby But Mine. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just reread a book by Jill Sorensen, and it takes place during an earthquake. And I'm like, well, that's my jam right now. I want to read a romance where the odds and, like you said, the stakes are so impossible. Like, they are not only are they trapped in an area, so it's got forced proximity, by an earthquake, it's like they're stuck on a section of highway that has collapsed. So they're in this, like, giant bubble with a certain number of people, including a busload of convicts. Like, I mean, it's already bad enough. You're trapped in rubble during an earthquake. We're going to throw a prison bus in there too. You know, Jill, like, just desperate.
Yeah.
Desperate situations. And I want to know, okay, yes, a romance is going to come out of this and they're going to be just fine.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the part, right? Like, I will now be able to read, because the promise of the HEA at the end means that no matter how high my discomfort is, there's, like, safety in rereading, right? Or keeping. I can keep going. Right. Because I know it's going to work out at the end, even if I don't know how. And so, like, these moments of either, like, you know, off the charts vulnerability or, you know, off the charts, like, just like, wow, the premise, there's so much going on in here. I have faith that the author is going to, like, sort of make it work at the end. And that's, I think, why, like, taking the finger, it's, I think, as a reader, when I see, and, you know, are sort of the opposite of taking the finger is, like, pulling the punch, is when I see people pulling the punch, I think, well, why? Like, what? And that's where I do feel like it's, like, that skill as an author. Were you afraid that your readers wouldn't follow you there? Were you afraid that, I mean, there's, like, lots of ways in which that gets played out, right?
And I think all that is real. I mean,
yeah.
Look, it's especially now for authors being public, like part of the job, right, is being public, which means we're constantly putting ourselves out there to get the feedback that maybe we don't always want. I mean, yeah. I think I can actually fully say we don't always want it, right? True. But, you know, we talk all the time about the reason why, I mean, Sophie and I have had this conversation 1,000 times, but the reason why Julie Garwood and Joanna Lindsay and Jude Devereaux and Judith McNaught were all kind of, each one was like constantly raising the bar on this wildness in the books is because they were only receiving feedback from each other. Right. So it was Joanna Lindsay wrote a Viking book. You know, some other person wrote a Viking book. Judith McNaught wrote a medieval. Julie Garwood wrote a medieval that was, you know, wilder. And like it just sort of they would read each other's books and then iterate them. And so, but now what we're all doing is we're getting constant feedback from readers, right?
Yeah.
Who are saying like, this didn't work for me because I was concerned about this theme or this, you know, this character didn't work for me for whatever reason, or like I'm divorced. And so I don't like to read books about divorced characters. Right. And so you end up kind of constantly getting this like barrage of feedback that is not new. I mean, every book has people who love it and don't love it. Even those old ones, especially those old ones. And, but instead of Judith McNaught, Judith McNaught never had to hear it. Right.
Unless people wrote letters, right?
Yeah. Yeah, but you would write letters to the publisher, and I don't think the publisher passed along the bad ones.
Right. I mean, they were writing into the void and following their id. Like, this is what they wanted to write.
Yeah. And so for us now, we're all struggling with like pulling the punch because we're afraid, you know, so and so will say such and such thing. Yeah. And that's challenging. And of course, you have to hope that you have a community of people around you who are going to say to you, like, stop worrying, just write the book. But I mean, it's harder and harder to shut out the noise, which maybe quarantine will help.
Yeah. Well, I also think that readers, you know, like there, I think I have great respect for one of the reasons I like really have been impressed by this, like Tasha Harrison book, though, too, is anytime someone can make me love a trope that I'm kind of like indifferent about, like I don't really dislike like sort of age gap where the woman is older necessarily. It's not, but it's just like never worked for me.
That's Sophie's jam, by the way.
Right. Oh, interesting. Well, you should read this. It's great. I mean, so it's really interesting.
I've already written it down.
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic. But you're like, seriously, you're going to love it. But it's one of those things where you're like, oh, here's a not, I mean, it's making me love Secret Baby. You know, that can happen, right? Like the opposite of hate is love. And so, of course, it's going to work for me at some point. But making me really care about something that I've been like, meh, it's just not really for me. I think that's the other thing is, you know, when writers are writing like their truth, whatever that is, even if it's not my truth, I see that in their writing. I don't know how, I don't know like
you're
what
feeling,
that magic is.
You feel it.
Yeah, exactly. Right? But I feel like there's something so, I don't know. Like, I feel like when I read books by people who are just really like, this is the truth in this book, then I recognize that truth, even if it's not my truth, right? And that's the joy of finding a great book. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. That's true.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that, Jen, you are a, you know, you always say like, oh, I'm a reader, you know, but you also are a critic, right? So you come at the books looking for what the writer is trying to do. Yeah. And you and I have talked about this before where we talk about, you know, what a writer is trying to do and whether or not they actually get there is almost less important than like the actual attempt.
Yeah. Well, this is like a good, maybe I've said this too, but like, so I, Michael Phillips, who's the Chicago Tribune movie critic, was a, I taught his son many years ago, and he, anytime someone interesting, I could like get in front of kids, and he actually came to talk to the students about movie reviewing, and he was great. And he was, sometimes people are great with kids and sometimes they're not. And he was great. And he said, and this has like really been a guiding principle for me as a critic, is he's like, I always ask myself 3 questions, right? So it's like, what is the work trying to achieve? does it achieve it? And was it worth achieving? And I think that that's been really important for me as I like think through, right? Because sometimes people take the finger and I think you shouldn't have, right?
Yes. Like,
yeah. Right. Yes. It's not every big risk or over the top bullshit thing you can think of is worth achieving.
No, like slave master romances, Nazi romances.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
these are things that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think.
Go ahead.
No, and I was just going to say, and I think that that's why it's like all three of those questions together are the ones that like really help me think about, because of course, I mean, sometimes I feel like, you know, people are like, oh, you're going to hate it. It's, you know, something you don't like, because I'm very clear about the things I personally like and don't like. And I was like, there are plenty of books I personally am like, yeah, it's not really my thing, but I see what it was trying to do and it did it and it was worth doing and it did it well.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's not really about me. And I think that that's like the problem when we talk about. So, you know, there are plenty of books that I think really are like, I'm trying to do something and I did it. Right? And
that's a great checklist to use. Every author should have that. Like,
yeah,
that's really, right away I'm holding it up against certain books of mine and I'm like, okay, yeah, that works. But yeah, like, you can't just for the sake of shock, write something. You can't just do it for the sake of here's bonkers, here's bananas. Boy, did I take the finger, but was it what? Why?
Worse.
Why? What's the risk?
Well, and here's other thing. I think fundamentally, taking the finger, the question mark that we all have to ask as writers when we're like facing that, when we're at that moment in the manuscript, is will it harm?
Yes.
Will it do more harm than good? Right. And
absolutely.
That is where I almost never, I mean, there's really literally nothing that I won't, you know, I'm not willing to try as a reader, except for these books where it just looks like a writer sat down and said, like, well, what's the most harmful relationship I can come up with? I'm going to write a romance in that world.
Right.
Yeah.
And like, look, I mean,
where the redemption is just absolutely impossible, but it's just so shocking. That's what I'm going to
do. And it's the difference between, for those of you who were with us last season for Immortals After Dark, it's the difference between, and I'm sorry that I keep bringing him up, but he's important, right? Declan Chase, Mr. Vivisection himself, who spends like 4 or 5 books prior to his own book where he is hero, you know, doing harm to immortals becomes a hero. And the only reason why that is allowed is because fundamentally the harm that he does to immortals does not harm readers.
Right.
And that is the only reason why, you know, don't ever come at me with, well, but my Nazi, you know, my SS guard, you know, he's like Declan Chase. No, he's not.
No, that's real harm.
There are no real vampires in the world who are being harmed. So,
which is why maybe we talked about it, taking the finger in sci-fi and historicals, well, to a degree, right? Sometimes it's just easier in paranormals, you know?
Sure.
I mean, I do think it's much more challenging in contemporaries than it is in anywhere else. Absolutely.
And that's why I think there's another kind of taking the finger, which I think is about carefully subverting reader expectations. And one of the people I think, a book I really think that did that well, was The Prince of Broadway by Joanna Shoup. And I'm gonna spoil the ending. So if you don't want to do that, because it's really about the ending,
skip ahead two minutes.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Skip ahead. Through the entire book, Florence is like, I don't want to get married. I don't really want to be a mother. And the epilogue of this book is that she and Clayton are not married. They're just living together in 1909 or whatever the fuck year it is. Right. I have no idea. I just made that up. And 1890s, whatever. And, you know, she's talks openly about, like, I don't think I want to have kids and I want to use birth control. How do you feel about that? Kind of like I'm telling you, but this is not really a discussion. And I will tell you, it took my breath away. Because I thought, I am so, and you know, we've talked a lot about like the baby log and this is what readers want, right? Yeah. But here is an example of, no, but this character wouldn't want that.
No.
And she didn't have to put it on page. That book could have just ended.
No. And that is a real risk.
Right.
Like, that is a fearless choice on the part of Joanna. Like, because, you know, the reality is most readers want that. What I will add to that is I'm not sure I've ever seen that in a historical.
I would agree with that. I would definitely agree with it. I mean, I don't know how many baby epilogues I've written. Yeah.
And that's it. And I thought she didn't have, not only did she not have to do this, right? The book could have just ended, but to say, to put it on page, like, no, HEA for Florence is going to be that she and Clay just like live above her casino and she doesn't want kids and that's fine. It meant something to me. I mean, I really remember reading it and being like, I didn't know I needed something like this until I had it, because I didn't even think such a thing could exist.
Exactly.
And how worthwhile is that to have that out there? Because here's countless number of romance readers, and they're reading a story where it about a woman that's okay not having children, you know?
Yeah, okay not getting married.
I mean, that's important. That's a valuable thing. Like, I've had to, you know, I've had to kind of like raising a daughter, I'm like, you may not want kids someday. That's okay. Like, I don't ever want to put that expectation on her. Even, I mean, you know, she very likely will, but who knows? If she doesn't, that is okay. A woman doesn't have to have that to be complete.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think like a similar like kind of pairing is I really like it's The Red and the Rose by Tiffany Rice. And in the first one, essentially the heroine of the first one is like the mother of the girl in the second one. And it becomes really clear in the second one that like the couple from the first one have continued to have an open relationship through their entire marriage. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, of course they did, right? Like, this isn't a couple that's going to like settle down into like monogamy or even like a sort of like closed polyamorous relationship. Like, it is a straight up open relationship. And I think that that also, I mean, you know, of course, I don't think anyone's reading Tiffany Rice who's not like, right? She's always pushing boundaries. But these are like the small ways in which I think you just see authors like making room.
Yep.
Right. Making room in the genre for a broader, bigger swath of stories.
Yeah. I mean, thinking about this, it's like when we did our bodily autonomy episode and we talked about all those books that like tackle abortion and tackle birth control, you know, real issues facing real women outside of the fantasy of the book. And that anytime anybody does that, I have such deep respect for it. And I think it's so important. You know, one of the other things that I want to talk about while we're doing this has now gone out of my head. I had a thing and now it's gone.
Well, I feel bad because I feel like this episode ended up being kind of like thoughtful and serious. And I didn't necessarily mean it to be that way. I thought it was going to be like really fun. So maybe make it fun again. Sorry, everybody.
I came back to me. But one of the things also that I want to talk about is this idea of the promise of the premise, which is also tied up in this conversation around being fearless. And this is such a tropey, when we talk about the tropes of the genre, when we talk about like bully romances or aphrodisiac romances or like, I don't know, like daddy romances, like all and often when we're talking about this is true of like all the tropes, but especially the tropes that are a little bit wilder. The reason why readers come to them is because they have an expectation for what that book should be, right? Like celebrity romance shouldn't, like, people come to, I love a celebrity romance, and people come to celebrity romances for the kind of reveal of normal person plus celebrity is a challenge, right? Because there's paparazzi and there's, you know, the opinions of the public and there's, you know, the queen.
If you're, you wait for those reveals, just like, you know, the heroine in disguise or the hero in disguise, or you waiting for the great. Yeah, there is that scratch my id.
Exactly. And there's this really interesting balance in these books where, you know, it's Sophie who says all the time, it's exactly the same but completely different, is the challenge in every romance novel, right? Like, I'm going to write an aphrodisiac book. Obviously, the money shot in the aphrodisiac book is the moment where they take the aphrodisiac and they cannot get enough, right?
Yeah.
But how are you going to write that so that you are scratching the itch of people who love aphrodisiac books, which is the whole reason why you're writing it, right? Because it's your jam too, but also writing it in a different way that sets yours on the table as a revolutionary version of this, or maybe not revolutionary. Maybe that's not fair because not every book can be revolutionary, but like yours is being set down on the table as one that will stand out by virtue of being exactly the same and promising the premise, but also completely different and doing it in an interesting new way.
These are all like considerations you have to take. And I'll go ahead and the book following this, the aphrodisiac, it is called The Duke Effect. It's coming out in the fall. And yeah, we will meet the aphrodisiac again. And the hero is going to have a taste of it. So that, I remember when I told Sarah about that, we were like, oh, that's going to be tricky when it's in his, you know, he's the subject of the aphrodisiac. So again, lots of little checklist I had to start thinking about, you know, consent, different things as well. You know, no one wants a totally lustful, out of control hero, or do they?
Yeah. I also think that this is why, like really clearly, like, I don't think this is any time to be coy with readers about what it is that they're going to experience, right? I mean, nobody wants to be surprised. You know, anybody who is like, you know, I really am just never going to enjoy a book where people are under the influence, right, of whatever. You know, they shouldn't. And that's the thing, I think, that, you know, like, just know the... Like, I don't know, like, no one should, like, fall into that accidentally, right? Like, there are certain books that I would never, like, you know, like, I think of, you know, like, Christine Fian is someone who's, like, she's doing a lot. Like, right? There is a woman who's, like, really, it's a lot. And I...
as Panther.
Yeah, sure, great. But that's also where it's like, if you're recommending books to people, just like realizing that, you know, when you're recommending a book where people are like really leaning into something that might be, you know, back to that, like, do no harm, you know, it's like, that's true as readers when we recommend books to each other too, right? Like, there's a reason why every single time we bring up an old school Joanna Lindsay, we're like, okay, by the way,
be careful.
Because, yeah, and the thing that's really hard is, when you read as much as, like, the three of us read, it's, I don't remember everything, right? I don't remember everything. And the things I might remember are like, okay, yeah, this might work for you. But I think that that's the part where you're like, oh.
I mean, it's definitely a danger if you're recommending an old school that you yourself remember from 15 years ago. And you're like, I haven't read it since, but I've done that. And then I went back and reread it at the same time I recommended it to someone else. And I'm like, oh my gosh. Like,
oh, there's horse cock in it.
Whoops. I did. I definitely should have warned you.
Sometimes we have to bring in the horses.
Sometimes.
I mean,
I did not remember solution. That from that book.
I remember that. I never forgot that line.
I do think at some point we need to have a conversation. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know how. I like to think I have cracked the nut on a lot of the history of romance and why things happened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But, like, the absolute disregard for, like, just the sheer wildness of those early books. Mm-hmm. How was it possible that they were all writing these wacky books at the same time? Like, and no one was saying, like, maybe that's too much. I mean, but I sent Sophie I tweeted this YouTube trailer of this movie from 1963 called Lady in a Cage. That is true. So I can't focus on anything right now because I don't know the world. And so last night, Eric and I were sitting on the couch and all we did for 2 hours was just, we were down the rabbit hole watching previews of old, like, weird movies that we'd never heard of before. And there's this movie called Lady in a Cage starring Olivia de Havilland. And the preview begins with Olivia de Havilland wearing like a proper dress and pearls, saying,
"My new picture, Lady in a Cage, it's a strong picture with a terrifying theme which affects us all. That's why I urge adult, responsible people to see Lady in a Cage. You will be shocked, you will be terrified and fascinated. So I caution you, do not see it alone."
And it's really, really like weird. And then the preview itself is bonkers. And it's just, I mean, it would never, ever get made today. And never in a million years, but probably shouldn't have been made in 1963 either.
I know. And with all people like Olivia de Havilland, you know, you think of as elegance. It's just, it was strange.
It's really bizarre. And so we'll link to it, but it's weird. And also you do have this moment where you're like, what was going on? Why were the movies like this? Why were the books like this? What is it that was happening? Is it just that like 50 years ago, romance was nascent, and so it was just like the Neanderthal version? I don't know.
I think romance as a genre feels such great responsibility towards not harming people.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things I appreciate the most, but I also think that it's then one of the reasons it's just complicated, right? Because I just stop reading, right? I think I feel like I'm lucky enough to just be able to like let that kind of slide off of me. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's like this really interesting question about like, you know, is this because I don't even know if I want to say this on the podcast, but I guess I would say, is it because women are so used to being, so many readers and writers are women and marginalized people, and they're always put in caretaking roles, that the idea that we have to like care for our readers this way is like an extra burden that other genres and other mediums don't feel?
Yeah. I mean, look, yeah. I don't know if you're going to want to keep that in the podcast, but the reality is, you know, it's a very legitimate way of thinking about it. You know, nobody asks James Patterson to do it.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, I just think maybe if it's phrased as a question, it's not, I don't know. We'll talk about it. But yeah, it's really tricky, right? Because when, like, certainly there are things on Netflix that are way more over the top, right, than anything I've ever seen in a romance. And yet the responsibility of romance seems to be greater. And I think that's just interesting.
Yeah. Maybe
because it's about feelings.
It's interesting. And yet we're all, and to find ourselves still so criticized, you know, that's even more interesting, right?
Yeah, well, like, you're right. We're doing such emotional work and nobody cares. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think phrasing it as a question is interesting. Like it seems so different how, and I don't know the answer to that, but I think about it a lot. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it is heavy and careful and thoughtful work. And then you still run across people who just, you know, acquaintances who follow me on Facebook that aren't my reader, but they're like acquaintances because, you know, whatever, my kid knew their kid 5 years ago. Are very dismissive of it and what I do. And I'm like, this is a thing out there that is very, we put a lot of, like, we care about it and it's important.
More now than ever, I think.
Absolutely. Totally.
Yeah. I think romance is doing a lot of work right now. A lot of heavy lifting. I think it's doing a lot of heavy lifting during the quarantine. I think people are turning to us in a really different way. And I hope that if you are turning to books that are a little bit bananas, that give you you're looking for something that gives you pure joy, that you will download or order from your local independent bookstore Sophie Jordan's The Virgin and the Rogue, which is out this week. And Sophie, tell us, where are you doing signed book plates? What are you doing? Because I know that you can't get to a store, maybe, but
my local indie is still shipping. That's Katie Budget Books. And I have all the links on my website. And they're still shipping. And you can just order it or you can order it signed because, you know, we have a whole system in place for me to get curbside. They're going to put the box in the back of my trunk and I'll bring them back a day later. So
nice. Well, make sure you sign them outside in the open air.
Yes, I'm still available to sign. Yeah, I was going to actually probably let them sit in my car for 24 hours before. They're all working from home themselves, the booksellers at Katie Budget Books, but going, you know, one at a time, they go into the store. And so they're still operating and they said they're doing okay. So I'm happy, you know, I'm pushing a lot of books and ordering myself through Katie Budget Books right now. It comes out in April and I have a free short story up.
We need to send it to Jen.
Yeah.
I mean, do hello.
It's
so delicious.
Speaking of quarantine reads right now, I wrote it like in a whirlwind of, you know, 5 days. It's 35 pages and it's forced proximity. And it's basically a romance that takes place in the same world as The Virgin of the Road, but it's below stairs. It's between a housemaid and the stable master. And it's called In Bed with the Stable Master. So,
we're just going to have to put a moratorium on all horse talk for a while on Faded Dates. So I'm going to need you to reconsider everything.
Jennifer.
I'm ruined.
Jennifer Prokop, did you or did you not do a Who Did It Better on a Horse post one time?
I would like to really defend myself because Who Did It Better on a Horse is a whole lot fucking different than Who Did It Better with a Horse.
Nobody did it with a horse. The hero made sure of it.
That's right. He was committed. He was dedicated.
You know I'm going to go fucking read that.
We're going to buddy read this right now. A new text thread is going to open and it's going to be Who Did It Better with a Horse.
Oh, no. Only another horse. That's who.
Okay. Well, that took a turn. Listen, everyone, this is Faded Mates and we love you and we love Sophie Jordan. Sophie, where can people find you? In your house right now. You don't have anything else to do.
I'm up in my office right now, but I'm on Facebook. Sophie Jordan on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, but not nearly as active. Instagram and Facebook are my playgrounds.
Okay. As we said, The Virgin and the Rogue is out now. You can pre-order. You can order it from Katie Budget Books signed by Sophie or from your own local indie that's working. Shout out to indie bookstores that are still running the show. And or you can order it in E and get it right this second to read.
Right away.
Please send us a voicemail. Leave us a voicemail message. Jen and I are just, we're dead of how much we love the voicemail messages that are coming through during quarantine. But if you're listening to us and you want to tell us about a book that you love or the book that blooded you, please do. The number is 646-450-3766. We use Overcast as a podcasting service here in Shea McLean. Overcast is made by Marco Arment, who puts it all up for free and is doing triple the work right now during quarantine. And we're so grateful to Marco because he's also got another product that is why show notes and images on your podcasting apps look so gorgeous. What else, Jen?
I don't know, you guys. Just take care of yourselves. That's it. That's all I got.
Yeah. Wash your hands.
I think Kelly's still shipping buttons, but you can also choose to, like, wait and hold if you want to, because I know that she's actually able to walk to a post office, but I know a lot of people have concerns about the mail, but I think, you know, it's complicated. Everybody's just trying to do their best.
Faded Mates is produced by Eric Mortensen. Be safe out there, you guys.
We love you all. Stay away from aphrodisiacs.
Well, I mean, wait, if you're quarantined with somebody who you love,
yeah, then try it out.
Get on aphrodisiacs.
I mean, hello.
Go for it.
All right.
Hi, Faded Mates. My name is Bailey, and I live just outside Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I first started listening to the podcast because I'm a librarian, and I wanted to learn more about the romance genre so I could give good recs. That was like a year ago, And now, especially like during these crazy times that we're all living in, it's basically the only reason I keep track of the days so then I know when it's Wednesday and I can listen to the new episode. But I grew up reading romance. My mom was a huge romance reader. She had like hundreds, if not thousands, of romance books in our house and in the garage attic. And like at night, I would sneak out of my room with my flashlight back to the boxes of books that she had. And I'd rummage through them, trying to find the juiciest ones I could find. Then I would take these back to my room and I would read them by flashlight. And one of the books I found was Sweetwind, Wildwind by Elizabeth Lowell. I know this because I remember making myself memorize the title and author so that one day when I was a grown-up, I could find this book again and read it. I don't remember, like, a whole lot about it. I know, like, the guy and girl, like, grew up on a ranch together, and, like, when she was in her teens, they kind of got together. But and one night, he takes her back to his place, and then they can finally do it. And right as when they're getting down to it, he walks away, leaving her naked and vulnerable and emotionally devastated. So flash forward to 10 years later, and she's back at the ranch for, like, inheritance reasons or something. Doesn't matter, because there's all this unresolved tension and lost love and misunderstandings that they need to resolve. And all I remember knowing is, like, how much he wronged her and needed to fix it. And one of the ways he does this is when they finally do get down and dirty again, he lets her take off all of his clothes, but she gets to keep hers on. And, like, that moment was so emotionally satisfying to me. I think, like, later in the book, he also, like, rescues her from a thunderstorm. There might be one of those you have to get married to inherit the ranch type things. Anyways, I loved this book as a kid. It's definitely one that blooded me. Thank you both so much for bringing me back to my love of reading romance, and I can't wait to hear the next episode. Thanks. Bye.